This is the Author Archive podcast. I'm David Freeman. In this episode, a wonderful book by Catherine Nixie. The book is called Heresy. But right at the beginning, right on the very front cover, before you open the book, there is a subtitle. Catherine Nixie is here. You're very welcome. I bought the book March 2024, so it's new. What does it say, Catherine?
It's Jesus Christ and the other sons of God. And obviously the fun is in that other.
So that title grabs the attention. Catherine, is this fiction or is it history?
Yes, you may ask. It's history about some things which may or may not have happened.
This book is a major feat of scholarship, huge amounts of work. It must be. So what drove you on? What kept you going? What was your thought?
Well, I mentioned this in the book, but I had a slightly funny upbringing in that my mother had been a nun and my father had been a monk. And they brought us up pretty Catholic at first. And so we went to church and we said grace before meals. We prayed before bed. When we went on holiday, we would go and see saints. We would go and see saints in Italy and things like that. And I kind of grew up, I sort of grew up believing this, really, a bit hazy on some of the details. But then when I went to university, I did classics just kind of by chance, partly because I was interested in the Latin I'd heard at church. And when you do classics, you start to realise that they're the version of Roman history that Christianity gives you, because Jesus is, of course, born into the Roman Empire, is quite different to the version of Christianity that the Romans record. And I suddenly realised that I had almost no idea what the Romans thought of Jesus or what they thought of religion or what they thought of kind of pretty much anything in this period. And so I started to read, and suddenly you find that what you had learnt at school, at Sunday school from your parents was really not the whole story. It was really one half of the Christian story. Until fairly recently, it's fair to say that Christian history was told almost entirely on the basis of Christian sources. And they sort of set their own homework, wrote their own homework and marked their own homework. So I thought, well, let's see what the other side said. And that's what this book is about.
You were born into a Catholic tradition. I was born into a Methodist tradition. And I was brought up, you probably were too, with gentle Jesus, meek and mild. These Jesus Christ and other sons of God, the ones of which you write, were they all meek and mild?
Well, no, of course. This is the best. This is one of my favourite versions of Jesus. So like you, I got the gentle Jesus, meek and mild version of Jesus. But in fact, there were plenty of other ancient Jesuses or versions of Jesus who were read about by Christians out there. So there was a Jesus who I absolutely love, who blinded those who bothered him and murdered those who irritated him. And he's magnificent. He is this sort of demon child, he's been described as. He's playing by a stream one day. And this is from a kind of relatively early text. It's a sort of early second century text. And this little Jesus is playing by a stream, and another boy comes up to him. And those of you who've seen small boys playing by streams will know see what's happening next. Jesus is damming the stream. The other boy comes up and breaks his dam. And so Jesus turns to him, and, you know, we're led to expect certain things of Jesus from the way that we were brought up. So we think he would, you know, turn the other cheek, or if the boy breaks one dam, he'd offer him his water cistern. And in fact, what Jesus does to him is he says, "You ignorant, godless ignoramus, what harm had it done to you?" And then he withers him is what happens. I mean, it's not quite clear what withering is, but it's definitely not good.
We know where the gentle Jesus, meek and mild, we know where that image comes from. This demon Jesus, where did you find about him? Where did you read about him?
So he crops up in a book known as the Infancy Gospel of Thomas. And there's lots of these. So there are four Gospels in the Bible. There are surviving remnants of over 40 that we have. So when you go to church, you're taught this is the word, you know, you're taught that the Bible is the word of God. But in fact, there were lots of other words of God that kind of, one way of thinking of it is, didn't make the final cut. It's not quite as simple as that. It's more like certain Christians read certain books, but these are all the other ones. And they caused an enormous scandal when they first came out in the 1820s or so. But they're fascinating, and you know, there's different versions of Jesus are talked about. There's a Jesus in one fragment who has sex with another woman in front of Mary Magdalene, which is a bit of a shock for anyone who's brought up in the kind of Church of England sexless Jesus. There's a Jesus who tells that his followers, well, the Jesus most people know is the Jesus who suffers the little children to come unto him. But there's another Jesus who tells people not to have any children at all, because children are all turn out to be either withered or crippled or grasping or lunatics or idiots, and their parents turn into and people, some people might agree with this, massive bores, because they talk, one assumes, because they talk about the children all the time. And there's just a huge variety of ancient Christianity. Scholars now talk about ancient Christianities rather than ancient Christianity to reflect this variety.
Why don't we know about these people? Why don't we know about these things?
Well, we don't know about them because the form of Christianity that won out was a form that decided that texts that didn't want you to. It decided that the texts that would be studied were its text. It decided on a canon. In Greek, that means a measuring stick, and the development of the canon is a very long and kind of fuzzy process. But it decided that there were kind of texts that were okay to read and texts that weren't okay to read. And this was true both within Christianity. So it created a kind of Bible. It decided what books were in it. I mean, much of that had been formed already, but it formalized it, and then it started to cast anathema on books that weren't in it, and it stopped copying them out. And in the extreme, it would destroy texts that it didn't like, or encourage people not to copy them out. And also, they just fell out of favor. But the funny thing is this deeply contradictory story, because some of these remain popular for centuries. So there's maybe we'll come on to it, but there's an extraordinary story about the Virgin Mary in one gospel that was enormously popular for centuries, perhaps rivaled some of the gospels that we know today in its popularity.
You better tell me about it.
Well, this is my other favorite one. I'm sure it's one of the ones that probably caught your eye as well. So this is in a gospel known as they all have incredibly long names, Proto-Evangelium of James. And it came down to us through something else called the Gospel of Pseudo-Matthew. They've always been kind of a sort of mosaic gospels. They were kind of being accumulated into each other. Anyway, so it tells the story of the birth of Jesus, this gospel. But unlike the gospels in the Bible, which bounce over the birth of Jesus pretty briskly, you might not feel like that if you've been to a Christian school, because you'll have been brought up doing the nativity, but really it's very, very snappy in the Bible. One book spends longer explaining the tax and travel arrangements of his parents than it does on the actual birth itself. And it definitely, they don't go into biology. The Bible really doesn't go into biology. But this gospel does. And it starts so that the scene of the birth starts as Mary and Joseph are traveling, and Mary is on a donkey, and they're traveling, and she's pregnant, and they are going, they're traveling near to a cave, it turns out. And while she's on the donkey, she says to Joseph, she basically says, "My contractions are starting." The phrase she uses is this wonderful, "The baby that is in me is pressing to come forth." And so they go into this cave, and then, which is a stroke of luck to find it. And then, by an even greater stroke of luck, they find a midwife who is there and able to help. And then Joseph goes to wait outside the cave while the birth takes place. And you can tell that the birth has taken place because Joseph is standing outside the cave and waiting, and he's watching the night. And then suddenly he realizes that everything in the entire world has stopped. So the stars have paused their nightly procession across the sky. A shepherd who had raised his hand to strike sheep had his hand frozen in midair. The birds have stopped mid-flight. Everything has stopped. And he realized that this is it. The child has been born. And then the scene goes back to the cave. And what happens is, next, it's sort of unbelievable to people who've been raised on the kind of version that we know. So the midwife runs out, and she's so excited, and she wants to tell everyone what's just happened. And she says, "A virgin has given birth." And there's a woman who's walking past, and she says, "I don't believe a virgin has given birth," kind of not unreasonably. And the midwife says, and I don't think this is wholly to her credit, says, "Well," and the woman says, "I won't believe a virgin has given birth till I come in and search for the parts." And thrust my hand in and search for the parts. And the midwife, and this is the bit that's not to her credit, says, "All right," and brings her into the cave. And she says to Mary, "Get ready. There's no small contention concerning me." And then this woman, who's just a sort of passerby, inserts her hand into Mary's vagina to see whether she really is a virgin. It's a virginity test. Now, we don't know what Mary thinks of this because she doesn't say anything, but her vagina's response is pretty clear because it burns the woman's hand clean off. Now, this sounds extraordinary to us. And it sounds, you think, how could anyone take that? How could anyone believe this? Or how could that be part of any religion? And this is why this story is so interesting, because these stories do vanish, but also they don't vanish. Because it's this gospel that the scholars think created the cult of the Virgin Mary. It was one of the most popular ancient gospels. There's well over 100 manuscripts of it left. It was translated into numerous languages, stretching all around the Mediterranean basin. If you'd gone to church, you would have heard it being read. And if you doubt that it was influential, I mean, you have seen its influence today, because if you ever see an image of a nativity with an ox or an ass in it, and of Mary riding on a donkey, then you're seeing its influence, because they're not in the New Testament. They are only in this gospel.
Reading your book, it reminded me of the Python's Life of Brian, because there are people there who seem astonishingly similar to Jesus. There's one, Apollonius.
Yes, Apollonius. Yes, I love Apollonius. You can't read. You can't read. Everyone starts their sort of stories on Apollonius in the same way, which is that you sort of compare his life with Jesus, because they are in some ways astonishingly similar. So, Bart Ehrman, who's a biblical scholar, does this in his lectures. He sort of gives a. You'll know who I'm talking about, and then of course he switch, does a switcheroo at the end. But basically, there was this man who was born in the reign of Caesar Augustus in the east of the Roman Empire, to a mortal woman. And when this in around the year sort of at around the turn of the first millennium, and when his mother is pregnant, a divine being appears to her and says, "You are you the child that is in your belly is divine. In fact, possibly more than that." People think that he is a God made incarnate in a mortal woman. And if that's not odd enough, when he's born, above his birthplace, there is a lightning bolt appears and hangs there. As he grows up, he's clearly remarkable as well. He has long hair, linen robes, walks about barefoot, all the like kind of old-fashioned prophetic staples. He's said to be able to heal people. When he's so charismatic that when he arrives in a town, the workmen leave their work and come to talk to him. And it said he can even raise the dead. So there's one miracle. And I think this is the one that struck me most of all about him, actually, is there's one miracle when he's walking through a town and he sees a funeral procession, and he walks over to it, and they're mourning because this girl was supposed to be getting married, and in fact she's died in the hour of her marriage, and they should have been celebrating, but in fact, they're walking through her through the city mourning. Now he approaches and he says, he basically says to the father, he says, "Stop your tears. I will stop the tears that you are crying." He seems to whisper something to the girl, and then she rises from her apparent death, and he gives her back to her father. Now, those of you who have brought up Christian will know this is almost identical. Now, actually, the wording, I mean, David, I don't know if you read it, but the word, you noticed it when you read it, the wording is startlingly similar to a miracle that Jesus himself performs.
When Christianity is starting off, I mean, you grew up in it, I grew up in it, and one of the features of organized religion is the schisms which seem inevitable. The minutiae, oh, you say that, no, but I know this is true. So, did this scattering of the belief systems and the confetti that follows, did that happen quite early on?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you can see hints of it in the New Testament. They seem to be arguing right from the beginning. Paul's clearly kind of having having a few kind of knocked a few contretemps with people already by that by you know by the time he's writing his letters. And it was one of the really notable features of Christianity, and it was notable to Romans. What's funny is when you read Roman descriptions of Christians, they just can't understand why they, and Saint Augustine says this himself, how is it that you, with all of your many gods, seem to be able to get along fine? We, with our one God, are all divided and rent asunder. A Roman historian says, no wild beasts are so dangerous to man as the Christians are to each other. They're constantly tearing each other apart. They're constantly schisming, and having sects and splitting. And it seems to be not despite the fact that they have one God, but because of it almost. There's this idea that if there is one way, one truth, one life, then if you are not that one, then you're the wrong one, and then you're damned, and that's important. It seems to be the thing. I mean, but there were other Christians who were much more mellow, but they didn't survive.
What about the God? I mean, when I was a child, I love that story that you went to church and you thought God had a name. Tell me
Well,
that. It's lovely.
Anyone who's brought up religious will know that you go to church way before you can understand anything, and you say all the things. And I thought that God had a first name and that it was Peter, because all the way throughout Mass we seem to say all the time, "Thanks, Peter God." And it seemed perfectly plausible to me that God would have a first name and that it was Peter. And so I just believed that for quite a long time.
This jealous God. I always thought that, I mean, Richard Dawkins says he's the most unpleasant character in fiction. But was this God always pretty repellent?
Well, what's fascinating is you get Christians who find him pretty repellent. So there are these wonderful texts called the Nag Hammadi Codices that are found in a jar in the Egyptian desert, in this sort of amazing kind of bolt from the blue discovery. They open this jar in the Egyptian desert in around 19, and it's around 1945, and this dust seems to come out, and at first they think somebody says, "Oh, it's a jinn, a sort of a spirit," but it's not a spirit. Possibly, what it is a manuscript kind of almost vaporizing. So one manuscript seems to sort of turn into dust as soon as it's opened. But then they open this jar, and inside there are these leather-bound books. Codexes is the ancient name; just means book. And in them there are the writings of what appear to be early Christians, although sometimes it's not quite clear what their affiliation is. And they're writing about God in a way that is mind-boggling to modern Christians, because they're not writing about him in the reverential way that you hear at church, where every kind of awkward corner of God is smoothed away. They're much more sounding a lot more like, frankly, like Richard Dawkins. So they find him irritating. They doubt him. So they say things like, God says in the Bible, "I am a jealous God." And then they say, "Well, why are you a jealous God if you're the only God? So either you're not the only God, or you're kind of one of many gods. And why are you jealous anyway? Because that's a kind of begrudging thing to be." And that they play with it. Somebody has likened these early Christian texts to being like kind of jazz riffs. And I think that's a lovely way of thinking of them. They kind of take the tales that you know, and they riff on them, and they play on them, and they critique them. And they laugh at God. They laugh at the story of Adam and Eve, because they sort of say, and God says to when Adam and Eve take the fruit of the tree, and then God says, to Adam, "Where are you?" And they say, "Well, why doesn't he know where he is if he's so omniscient?" They're constantly picking apart the Bible, but they do appear to be what we would probably call one kind of Christians. And it's just that there were many different ways of being Christian, many different texts, but also many different mentalities that seem so strange to us.
The byline on the cover of your book, Jesus Christ and Other Sons of God. I mean, I don't think we were ever taught in Sunday school, but the thought was it was Jesus who was always meek and mild and a real goody-goody, and his mother and father who were saints. But there was no annoying sibling. When you read in the depth that you have done, does he come from a family? Does there a sister? I mean, at some point you say that there's a thought that he had a twin.
Yeah, so there's this odd book called The Acts of Thomas, and this is the one where Jesus and it's not he's described as Thomas is described as Jesus's twin. So this is Thomas the Apostle, and he's described as his twin, but to put it mildly, it's not quite clear what it means when it says he's his twin, because it's sort of the theological complications of the idea that when Mary was made pregnant by God, there were two of them, in fact. I mean, that hardly bears thinking about. If you've got over Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, if you then have Father, Holy Son, Holy Ghost, and the other Son, I mean, what do you do with that? So what it seems to be is not that he's his actual twin, but it's that he appears to be able to, they appear to look very similar. That seems to be the simplest way of thinking it. But this is the Thomas who is sent to India, and Jesus sends him to India as an apostle of his. And he sends him away to kind of spread the word in India. And this is the Thomas who ends up saying things like "don't have children," and he's very against reproduction. But that one of the things I thought was most interesting was that it wasn't just Apollonius, and it wasn't just these other tellings of Jesus, that the idea that there were people around who were sons of God who were born of mortal woman who could heal people was incredibly common. And when you read classical critics, which of course you tend not to if you're brought up as a Christian, but they say this. There's this writer called Celsus who I love. Who says of Jesus, well, there are others, he says, who go around begging and pretending to be sons of God. And he kind of gives the impression that if you go to the marketplace in the East of Empire, sort of you'd be hard pressed not to bump into somebody who can, in Celsus's words, blow away demons or make your diseases go away, or for an, heal the blind, cure the lame, and give you some hair-raising predictions about the future as well. And Celsus has this lovely bit where he goes on saying sort of, they're all telling you that, oh, the world's about to be destroyed, but you just believe in me and you'll be saved. And he says, Celsus is very dry and very acerbic. And he says, well, how do I know which of you chances to believe? Because if you're all telling me that I'm going to die and be doomed unless I believe in you, then how do I choose who to follow? Do I roll some dice?
Honestly, last question. So what these people can do and what they say they can do is very akin to magic. And there's pictures in your book of Jesus, the one we know, with what looks like a magic wand.
These are amazing, these pictures, and they were kind of initially quite disturbing to Christian scholars. They spent a long time trying to say it wasn't a wand, it was a rod. Anyway, it's a kind of pointless argument working out what English word you're going to give to a picture that was drawn 1,800 years ago. But yes, in early images, it's one of the most common things that Jesus is hot seen holding, a long thin stick when he does miracles. So you see him holding a long thin stick when he changes water into wine, when he changes, when he makes the loaves and the fishes, when he raises the dead. And when you read ancient magical papyri, magicians did all of these things. So you find magical papyri are, well, exactly what they sound like. They're pieces of papyrus which have magic spells on them. And they're very difficult to date. They were almost all lost because Romans and Greeks didn't much like magic, and kind of ruled against it. You could get ferocious punishments as a magician. Christians liked it even less. And it was thought that almost all of these had been lost. And then a whole chunk of them were discovered. And when you read them, you find that the magician will offer to do all sorts of things. He can become a god. He can help you become a god. He can cause the foamy sea to become frozen so that you can run over its curling waves. He can show you how to heal the blind, cure the lame, raise the dead. It is all of these things are absolutely standard magic tricks of the time. And this is what the Roman critics said. This is what Celsus says. This is what Lucian says. This is what another writer called Porphyry says. And there was a modern scholar who wrote a book called Jesus the Magician, which still gets people cross today. And what his point was that if you read Christian texts, they think he's the son of God. If you read writings by pretty much anyone else, they say that he was what they would have called in those days a magician, i.e., a trickster, a charlatan.
You call your book Heresy. Why?
Heresy, well, partly because it's a fun word, heresy, and partly because in ancient Greek, so it's a Greek word, it comes from the Greek hiereo, which means I choose. Well, it's kind of slightly more complicated than that. Greek's got sort of masses of endings, but basically, hyreo means I choose. And in the word form hyeresis, it means something that you choose. It means a choice. So originally, it meant kind of a philosophical school. So if you followed Galen, you would belong to the hyeresis of Galen, say, Galen the medic. But what happens in Christianity is that it changes its meaning. So until Christianity, heresy is basically a wholly positive term. They've scanned ancient Greek literature to see if it has any negative connotations, and it doesn't, because to the Greeks, to make a choice through the use of your independent reason was seen as a good thing. When Christianity comes along, really almost nothing could be more dangerous. So the word heresy starts to mean heresy as we would know it. But it's kind of almost worse than that, because when they're talking about heretics and when they're talking about heresy, they use this incredibly freighted language. So they say it's a poison, they say it's a danger, they say it's demonic. Heretics themselves are snakes and scorpions and serpents. And the word changes its meaning entirely from choice and reason being a good thing to choice and reason being really more or less one of the worst things that you can do.
This book is called Heresy by Catherine Nixie. Absolutely superb book. See, huge congratulations, and thank you for talking to me.
Thank you very much for having me.